Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. I'm joined by Tom.
Hi.
Kirigo.
Hi.
And Hugo.
Hello, everybody.
We kindly ask you to subscribe and to leave a review of this podcast on whichever platform you use so more people can find us. With the passing of Godard, we're here to reflect on his career, both the highs and lows and everything in between. Tom, take it away with a brief history of, well, who knows?
Well, yeah, so I don't have a cold open because I have a massive migraine and I'm sitting here with Jean-Luc Godard sunglasses on.
Your sickness is also giving like Jean-Luc arrogance.
Yes.
It fits the theme very well.
So I'm just going to break the rules of the cold open. As
just like Jean-Luc Godard broke like the rules of cinema, eh?
Wow.
ding. Maybe it's best to just have a little bit of history about how the French New Wave, this massively influential movement, if we can call it that, started out. It's the end of the world. It's end of World War II. Here it goes already. Wrapped up in laughter.
Oh my God. I've studied history and then now you're giving me this.
Not going to lie, end of World War II gave many people a massive migraine.
I thought that was a moment of relief. And suddenly, shit, we have bills to pay. Well, actually, that's rather funny because bills to pay is what France had. Lots and lots of war debts to pay to the United States. Because during 1930 and 1936 and 1940, there was like a massive restriction of American films in France. There was like a quota. And due to a sort of agreement between the Secretary of State of America and the Ministry of France, they lifted the war debt. What they wanted back in return was that the American market could sort of take over France. So all the quotas for American films were lifted from, I think it was like 130 movies per year could enter France. And suddenly, so there was this huge tidal wave of American cinema hitting France because the quotas were lifted. And in this era, Jean-Luc Godard grew up together with his fellow film critic buddies. Well, let's just name a few. François Truffaut, Jacques Rivette, Claude Chabrol.
Jean Pistache.
There was a new generation who finally had the power to see, like film noirs and B-movies and movies by Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles and these American filmmakers who were very much in their own right, and we'll come to that later on, authors of their own style or brand of filmmaking. And inspired by that, like all these guys were like film critics. They were dubbed the Young Turks, which I still find a very dubious, strange name. I have no idea where it comes from. Somebody can write in and tell me how the hell these guys were called that. But they realized that they could potentially make films that they wanted to make outside of a studio system where there were lots and lots of sort of rules that impacted how a film would be made. Like a lot of conformism to continuity and how to tell a story and et cetera, et cetera. So in 1961, Godard decided to get, based on a story by Chabrol and Truffaut, to make Abou de Souffle.
Si vous n'aimez pas la mer, vous n'aimez pas la montagne, si vous n'aimez pas la ville, allez vous faire foutre.
New York Herald Tribune.
Patricia.
Je voudrais comme serait Romeo et Juliette.
Oh là là.
To wrap this up really quickly, the rest is sort of history. Because that movie so firmly impacted 60s cinema from a, let's name a couple of things that it really changed. Like, okay, so Abou de Souffle is about a guy who's completely obsessed with American identity. Jean-Paul Belmondo is the actor who completely sort of tries to portray a Humphrey Bogart. And he also, in the beginning of the film, is looking at a picture of him, and he thinks he's a gangster, and he kills a guy in the beginning of the movie and sort of tries to escape that crime. But it's a very simple story that's told in a incredibly hectic, playful, quick manner, mostly due to the editing, which was for the first time the jump cut was used in such a way where it was not only an edit going from one scene suddenly to the next, but it also just really disrupted the continuity of a story for the first time. So where usually the conformity of filmmaking would be that if you have two people talking, you have a long shot and then a two shot and then a single close-up and another close-up and another one. And that's how stories were told. And if you would go from one scene to the next, if you could go from one location to the next, there would be a fade. And what Godard does is, especially if you look at the beginning of the movie, when he's driving in his car, it's just constant shots of different... I could not now look at it now with this migraine, like these constant sort of really jumping shots from one to the next. It was an innovation and it was super playful and it was very much a testament to the times. Like times were changing. Like the Cahiers du Cinéma, film critic, all of them like looked back at the conformist cinema, if I can call it conformist, like the cinema of old, and called it cinéma du papa. It was just this sort of rusted, eroded thing that wasn't necessarily bad, but they just wanted to add something new to it. And from that came a very sort of personal brand of cinema that we now call author cinema or camera stilo. It also is very important in that like the, you can, I think it was the first moment where like really an artist could be known for stylistic things like in his film as well. And if you look at that, so many things like, to wrap this up, sort of echoed through history. There is no Quentin Tarantino without Godard. There's no Wes Anderson without a lot of Nouvelle Vague.
This is not really selling Godard to me.
No, but I'm not saying that his influences are. So let's maybe go back to a quote that I bumped into while reading up on this. Was there's this rather hilarious interview, and there are many hilarious interviews with him where he says the same thing, where Tarantino says that he had outgrown Godard. He was the most important filmmaker in his early years, and then when he got older, he realized that, well, he explains it that he was actually more obsessed with a review by Pauline Kael of the film Bon Appart than really with the film itself. That he was looking for something that what Godard did was like he made pulpy films, but sort of it was almost like he read a pulp novel, but the movie that he made of it was more the poetry between the lines than it was as necessarily like sort of the adaptation of the mm-hmm. pulpiness. Uh-huh. That's the same thing how Godard, I think, emanates film noir. It's like he's seen all these American films, but in between the lines, there's this existential thing that he actually takes out of it. And that's what his movies are really about. So I get that, and I get that Tarantino says that, and I myself have it a bit too, that I don't necessarily want to revisit a lot of Godard's that I really, really impacted me when I was younger, because I have the feeling that maybe I would look back at them now very differently. But no, what you said is completely true.
It's just that, you know, Godard is infinitely more interesting than either Tarantino or Wes Anderson will ever be for me. But it's
really?
Of course. I mean, but we'll get there in a bit. I think it's maybe good for full disclosure to acknowledge two things, because I feel like we're starting this episode from a very specific point, but we also have to acknowledge Godard is dead now, so now we can fully take his oeuvre. Godard is dead.
Let's
long live the new Godard.
Now
we can finally, I guess, wrap our heads around the entirety of Godard, which is very messy because he was many things at the same time. But also, Tom, that you have set up a new distribution channel and are releasing some of the Godards in the Netherlands, some of the early ones. And I think it's good to, full disclosure, announce that, but also talk a little bit about which films you have and which one of those you would like to revisit. Because it's funny that you say, I'm anxious or kind of like not sure if I want to revisit some of the films, and you're actually reintroducing some of them as well. So how do you, like, what films did you manage to get? Which films are screening in the Netherlands, and what's special about these films for you? I think A Bout de Souffle, like you said, it's very hard to understate how important the jump cuts in that film are, because they are literally everything. They are the essence of modern cinema.
Wow.
And film art in general. They are. So, but what about the rest of the movies that you're screening?
Well, let's do a real jump cut. Like, so when he died, a program that I wanted to do for many years, which was just way too expensive to do for Lab 111, came sort of back out of the refrigerator. And it was a program that is his run from his debut to Pierrot Le Fou. He makes like a great film every year from that moment on. And he even releases two in the same year, because Une Femme est une femme is released in the same year as A Bout de Souffle. So it's A Bout de Souffle, Une Femme est une femme. I think it's Den Vivre Sa Vie, Le Mépris, Alpha Ville, Pierrot Le Fou. And I really wanted to do that, like in a sort of early Godard program for years, but it was just too expensive. And then when he died, I said to another cinema in Rotterdam, like, hey, shall we do this together? And then there was another cinema in Maastricht which said, hey, can we chip in? And then somebody said, I can ask all art house cinemas in the entirety of Holland if we can all do this in sort of huge retrospective together. And then that ended up being such a strange situation, because I was talking to the rights holder for five of the films, and they suddenly said, like, well, maybe it would be interesting for you, because we had already started a distribution company to release some other films, to maybe buy these films for a short period of time so you can screen them for longer and more and not do single screenings, which we pay a lot for, then just to have those films and then release them nationwide. So that ended up being the five Studio Canal titles, which are A Bout de Souffle, Le Mépris, Une Femme est une femme, Alphaville, and Pierrot Le Fou. So that's kind of how that came to be. And now in November, we will be doing a retrospective, and we are now not screening those films all twice, but are just the entire program is just taken over by five daily screenings of Godard movies.
I remember you saying once that Pierrot Le Fou used to be your favorite film.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's in some ways still is.
Beau comme tout.
C'était un film d'aventure.
Son sang coulait de mille blessures et il combattait seul. Car il avait juré de ne pas reculer d'un pouce.
C'était un roman d'amour.
Sortir d'un mauvais rêve.
C'était un film d'aventure.
Ah, quelle terrible 5 heures du soir.
C'était un roman d'amour.
Nous vîmes des paysages d'hiver et des paysages d'été.
Compère vous mentez.
In a previous episode, I said, like, I picked one at some point, because I think it's a stupid thing, a favorite film, because you constantly change in it. Like, on Sunday, it can be something, and on Tuesday, it's something else.
I don't.
No, but I just picked Vertigo, and that's for now will always be my favorite movie. But sort of even in the prism of Vertigo, I must say that maybe it makes no sense for me, because to have Pierrot Le Fou as my favorite film, because Le Mépris is way more a film that sort of connects to the core themes of Vertigo and male-female incredibly fucked up relationships that I really enjoy in cinema.
And what's not to...
What's not to love.
Yeah.
No, but I mean that all those films are very interesting studies of how things can go terribly wrong.
That's beautiful.
I really believe in love. No... No, but yeah, when I first saw Pierrot Le Fou, it completely blew me away. And I realized later on that it's a very interesting turning point in his career as well. And we'll discuss that later, because Hugo, I think, would love to speak about his later career.
I do.
So let's just start with that trajectory. A Bout de Souffle is, for me, a hard one to like, because there's so much pressure on you as a film buff viewer of this movie is so influential, you must now really enjoy it.
For me, that's funny, because I enjoy that one maybe the most, because despite that image that it has and its importance in film history, it's still just such a snappy and enjoyable
It's my
movie.
Favorite Godard as well.
Well, it's amongst my favorites, and it has to do with the jump cut and the film history context, but also because it's just a really fun and energetic film, and just the characters are so captivating and so in their own kind of like realm, and so also in their own bubble compared to what's happening in Paris around them. I just also really like that you can see that they embody something radical also on the streets of the city itself. They are new. They are a new phenomenon. Just the speed of the movie, which is reflected in the editing, but also in the performance style, is incredible. And when I saw that when I was studying film at university, it totally blew my mind. It really blew me away, because it just opens up this whole new avenue of thought about film. True, let's be honest, basically a kind of mainstream movie as well at the same time. It's not a hard movie to get into. So I absolutely love that one. But you do as well, Kirko.
Well, I generally don't really like Godard as much as I think both of you. So I've seen, I think, all the classics, and like I've tried to watch Histoire du Cinéma, but I didn't. But I never really generally enjoyed a Godard film. And I think A Bout de Souffle is the one I've enjoyed the most because you feel the playfulness all throughout the film. Whereas for all his other films, I feel rather than enjoying a film and following a story, much more the need of Godard to prove something, which I think is inherent to most of his work, where he's always trying to battle all the ideas that people have on him as a critic, as, you know, having to prove that cinema is as worthy as all other forms of art in France. And it's kind of like dragging me down.
I think he did a brilliant job with Le Mépris to, at the one hand, acknowledge the compromises that he had to make, but then also turn it into an almost essayistic point about compromise and commerce versus artisticity or something. I felt like there he went through that whole thing that you're describing, that whole process, and saw it through the other way and somehow managed to turn the thing around its own head.
Right.
I thought that film really stuck the landing for me. So that's one of my other favorites as well.
Je t'aimais tellement. On n'avait pas beaucoup d'argent. C'était bien quand même.
Tu m'as dit que tu m'aimais. J'ai certainement dit.
On lui a dit que vous avez une femme très belle.
I do agree that there is a moment where I think the image of Godard himself is weighing down the films that he was making. And there's also definitely a point where he totally drops that ball and does his totally own thing. And it's possible to categorize anymore, which is for me the most exciting era, but we'll get there in a bit.
So the funny thing is, I am sort of emotionally completely in between you two. This is the reason why I'm hesitant to revisit them. Confessional corner. When I was really young, I was a black turtleneck wearing pretentious child in high school. When I first saw these films, I got teased a lot before that.
You were doing your own thing. I respect that. Word, bitch. Look where you are now.
So Godard was like perfect for me. He was like, yeah, you can be like a little pretentious fucking brat and just do whatever the fuck you want and get flack and then get sort of something out of it. I have no idea. But there is a very sort of, hey, look at me doing this thing in many of his films.
Yeah, they're in a sense sometimes quite presentational, especially when his Marxist politics get
they're
into
performative.
The
they're very performative. Yeah. But the funny thing is, if you take something that I learned later on, if you look at the way he, for instance, very much influenced Scorsese, all the things that Godard sort of utilizes, like jump cuts or the use of irises, for instance, so that you have like the iris pulling in and you can focus on something, or the way he uses camera movement, which is very obvious in like Goodfellas, where the camera is moving with people, which is something that started in Nouvelle Vague because suddenly people were using handheld cameras and you could have the camera be essentially, you can have an audience feel that they're watching a film because you're using the camera in such a strange way where you go like, wait, hold a minute, this makes no sense. Or the freeze frame at the beginning of Goodfellas when Ray Liotta says this.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
Is a direct reference to Jules Legime, where Truffaut is constantly using freeze frames. In Scorsese's films, is that it's a sort of an evolution of what those guys were doing. He uses it very much for sometimes narrative or emotional impact. And in the films of Godard, it just sometimes feels it's only there either for the experiment or to say like, yo, look at this shit. This is crazy what I'm doing right now, right? And I hope I haven't outgrown that sort of playfulness that's in there. I really hope that when we're screening the films, I hope I will look at them and think about myself and think, oh yeah, I used to be that turtleneck wearing little brat.
No, but I think you'll be right. And to be honest, I'm also saving rewatching some of these Godards for when I can see them in the cinemas in the Netherlands, because hey, what better place to watch them than in the actual cinema with people and experience them kind of anew. I think you'll be right, because I also think it, you know, often you see a film for the first time, maybe you watch it for the story and you pick up on some other things. I think if you acknowledge that Godard always, you know, was also a critic and an essayist in a sense, and a rebel and a political agent in a sense as well, and all of his films start to reflect that as well, then there will be another level that you will pick up on. Like, every freeze frame that he puts in his film is not just there to fuck around with the film image. There is a philosophical underlying idea that he has about film and time, about life and death, about politics, about relations between people, about capitalism, about all these other kind of things. So a freeze frame can mean a lot of things depending on the context in which you see it, but also depends in which context you are when you are seeing it, of course. So I'm kind of really excited about seeing them in the cinema again. It's been a while, to be honest, with many of them. They will probably feel anew. That's at least my impression that I'm getting from the rewatchability of his movies.
Absolutely not pretension for pretension's sake.
Yeah.
I 100% agree. When we got all the stuff for the films, we had to work on the subtitling. And there was this really funny thing that I realized, that there's actually, with his films, there is literally something linguistically between the lines.
Yeah.
Even there, sort of, there's playfulness on one side and then hyper serious, pretentious intellectual shit on the other side. But they are constantly sort of meshing with each other, yeah, in this very awkward way. At the end of Abu Dussouf, there's the infamous, famous line.
Qu'est-ce qu'il a dit?
Il a dit, vous êtes vraiment une dégueulasse.
Qu'est-ce que c'est, dégueulasse?
Spoiler, Belmondo dies. He says he lips something, and then the guy standing next to Jane Seberg, she asks him, what did he say? And the guy says, well, so I can't translate it because that's the entire thing. What the guy says, I think, is, you are a slut. But the word slut, or in the thing that they use, is dégueulasse, which is a word that also means to vomit or puke. So the English translation is, he says,
you make him vomit.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not necessarily what he says. So when she says, what is a vomit? It's such a strange situation, because like, the movie is stuck in this sort of, what? No, the entire interpretation of this thing is like, because I was watching it, so I could change the subtitles for that. And I thought like, what is the word to choose? Especially in Dutch, because our language is even less lyrical than English.
Coarse. Yeah.
So now comes the ending of Pierrot Le Fou, which is beautiful. There is so let's do the spoiler again. Belmondo dies. And the camera pans to the right, and it's just the sea. And there's no sound, and you only hear like a fire in the background. And suddenly you hear Anna Karina's whisper.
Elle est retrouvée.
Quoi?
L'éternité.
C'est la mer allée.
Avec le soleil.
It's a small part from a poem by Arthur Rimbaud, which is, so she has been found, what, the sea and the sun. But it's recited in the film in such a way that it could be really funny, because you're looking at the sea. So she's been found. And then Belmondo asked her, what? That's just the sea. It's not poetic at all. So when I got the translation again, I was like, should the word just be in there? Should it just be the sea? So it's funny. Or should the word just be out? So it's a translation of the Rimbaud poem. It's again this sort of, it's being very playful with very heavy intellectual stuff.
In that sense, he was, you know, an omnivore and just so constantly intellectually hungry that, you know, he couldn't stop himself, it seemed. And later he just mostly is more interested in literature than in cinema, because if you acknowledge that both film and, you know, the novel or whatever are both mediums that employ a certain kind of language, then the language of film after a while becomes very coarse and sturdy and inflexible, because, you know, you need to literally show a thing for it to exist in a film and do something with it. Or you have to be very good and work with anti-images and after-images and whatever. But, you know, you show a thing and it exists in the film. Whereas with language, you can convey a lot of things through these kind of like play of words that you're now describing. And I think he was incredibly conscious of those things. And I think a linguist would maybe watch his development of his cinema style and see many things in how he developed a kind of like image and a montage that was uniquely his own, and see how it relates to poetry and literature and other art forms. But later on, he just kind of like loses his trust somehow in film altogether, because it is not enough for where his mind is going. And he really comes back to the book all the time in his later work as well. I mean, his last film is called The Image Book, which makes sense because he was more interested in film as an image book than as a narrative film per se. So it's very funny that you're mentioning these things, because I wasn't aware how acutely he was working with those things in his early films. So that's really cool. Yeah.
That's why my fascination with him stops after Pierrot Le Fou, because Pierrot Le Fou is very much not from a narrative, because Pierrot Le Fou is just Badlands, but then made by a French director, really.
Mm. That's so nice.
Nice, yeah. French Badlands. There's almost the entire thing with them living on an island is the exact sort of same, I don't know.
Le Père Malade.
Terre de Mal.
Terre de Mal.
We just lost like 50 French listeners. There are a lot of non sequiturs in Pierrot Le Fou, which are just sort of, yeah, like these political non sequiturs where he just goes into Vietnam, for instance, and makes these very, these very brash sort of anti-capitalist statements, as you said before. Yeah. Before that, it wasn't really in his work. Yeah, it's in Petit Soldat, for instance.
Yeah, and in Le Chinois, of course, yeah. It really gets there. And, you know, that's a fascinating period, of course, because there's a brand of communism around the time, based mostly also around Maoism, which is, you know, didn't really age that well.
Yeah.
But took a lot of the French and European or Western intellectual elites by storm. And he was a big proponent of that as well. I mean, it's good to also just mention again that in 1968, he was the one, together, I think, with Truffaut, right, who's handing in the curtains of Cannes and saying that film is just too bourgeois compared to the things that are happening on the streets. And I think that's very interesting, though, that this is a person that, you know, film and all these other things are his bread and butter for the longest time. But when push comes to shove, he's handing in the curtain of the biggest film event of the year to say, what the fuck are we all doing? Let's go out on the streets. You know, there's workers and students on the streets. So I do like that he had a political compass that was dedicated to causes without only being a salonfähige socialist or something. So it was always, I guess, there, the awareness, but it became more of a leitmotif in his mid-era of his work, instead of like the other way around, that a story could dance around it and it would have some elements.
Yeah.
Then suddenly that became the thing that the story should be about, yeah. Right? That was what the characters were fighting about ideas and ideals. So that totally flipped his kind of cinema as well, I guess.
Kiriko, yeah. Does this conversation change at all how you look at Godard?
No, because I agree upon all the things that you say. I mean, that's what I was saying. Like, his intellectual take on what he makes is evident, and he's experimenting. He's really thinking everything through, and you feel it throughout the film. But because of, I would say also, the lack of empathy that I feel in his films and sort of the douchebaggery aspect of his characters speak for him so much.
I was wondering whenever we would get to that point where he's also seemingly quite unlikable. And I wanted to ask you...
Please don't mention the scene from the Varda movie.
Yes.
Let's mention the scene.
I want to mention the scene.
It's one of the... I saw it this afternoon again, and it's one of the coldest, bitchiest, whiniest, shittiest things I've ever seen anybody do.
Okay, I'm gonna bracket it because some people might have not seen it.
Exactly.
One of the most famous late films of Agnès Varda is Faces, Places, Visage, Village, in which she and JR, right, go across the French countryside meeting people, photographing them, kind of making this kind of like road movie / cinema memoir / kind of like reflective documentary document about the work of Agnès Varda, and then this JR guy is also there all the time and making photos of people, and they put them on walls and stuff.
No, he's actually the artist making the photos and doing the things.
Well, but you know, where I have an opinion about JR, and I think it's going to be dissenting from yours, maybe. But there is a critical moment where they go to Switzerland to Godard's house, and because, you know, Varda, even though she was not officially part of the Cahiers gang back when the Nouvelle Vague became a thing, she was a bit of an outsider compared to also her late husband, Claude Chabrol. They were all associated, of course, in the same cinematic movement, the Nouvelle Vague. So she figured one of the final also still living members of this grand cinematic moment in history is Jean-Luc Godard, and they go to visit him, I guess, to have a conversation about the old days and old age and whatnot.
But I think the idea is also, so the reason why she does it is she says to JR, you always wear black sunglasses, as does Godard. And she has the idea of bringing this young, new, upcoming French artist who is doing new things in France together with one of the old masters of the country.
So they arrive at his doorstep. They brought him like his favorite brioches or kind of like pieces of bread. And they knock on his door. And guess what? He doesn't open. And for a lot of people, that put like a definite mark on who Godard is, a douchebag. And I'm wondering...
Well, it goes even deeper. When Chabrol died, the only message that Jean-Luc sent to Varda was the address of the restaurant that they all used to eat together at. Without any explanation, without any, I feel for your loss or anything like that. It was just the address. And Varda had told him that she thought that was really cold. And it like a sort of strange, l'art pour l'art, weird ass kind of thing to do, as you said. Not empathetic at all. And then when they arrive at his house, he has written on the window, on the inside of the window, the exact address again of the restaurant where they used to eat. So this started like 30 years ago, right? And it's like, just, you are here. I know you're coming. This is my message again for you. This is who I am. I can't change. I have zero empathy. Here's that message again. Just the address where we used to eat with your husband.
This motherfucker. And then also, she is the nicest woman of France. Like,
it's such a strange thing to do.
I'm going to defend Amir because, let's be honest, JR is a fucking hack.
And if, no!
Yo, he is. He is a fucking hack.
But it's not about him.
No, but it is, because I would be fucking pissed as well if I were Godard and this fucking douche just comes on my stoop. I would be, leave me the fuck alone. He's old as well. Let him have his own old age. He's not the same as Varda.
What the fuck does JR have to do with this, man?
Well, like, okay, so in the film, Agnes is like, and it's a dumb idea. She's like, you look like Godard, let's go see him.
That's adorable.
To be honest, I like Varda, but this is sometimes also what I dislike about her artistic sensibility, that she just sees two literal things, combines them, and it becomes something else. I prefer the thing where Godard is on the backside of things and is ruminating through it. If I were in my house and that fucking douche shows up, I wouldn't open as well. It's a travesty that she brought him to the door.
But it doesn't vindicate what Godard does.
No, exactly.
No, actually it does, because I wouldn't want to participate in that film. I like that film despite JR. I like
but
it because
fine.
Agnes
but
is
that's
a fine,
fine
person.
Then just don't fucking participate in that film, but don't fucking bring back like... old nasty trauma, like a beef you still have with somebody, and you sort of stipulate.
Well, this is on
that,
them.
You know?
This is probably more complex than that. I can't comment on that, but they are filming. They are filming his house. You know, he can just choose to not open it. I'm sorry. And you know, also because you know, at the late stage of his life, Godard becomes a total recluse. You know, he lives in Switzerland. The only
for
thing,
a reason.
For a reason.
For a reason.
Yeah.
Switzerland, the only place where you can euthanize yourself without any problem.
True.
That's why Alain Delon lives there as well.
Yeah. And he died because of that. That's his way that he passed, which is, you know, great.
Yeah, he's the author of his own life.
Well, maybe that lacks some empathy, but he becomes a recluse. He becomes interested in an elemental form of the arts that he was, you know, known for. And he's making a totally different project than anybody else's. And I think a lot of people... like took offense to his turn of artistic interest and output and his image. Yeah, he is a bit standoffish and he can seem in that sense also insensitive and childish, and maybe he is. I'm not defending his character necessarily, But as an artist, I totally get why he's not opening that door. To be honest, he had better things to do. You know, his late work actually is some of my favorite things I've ever seen. I think the second Godard I ever saw in the cinema was Audio au Langage, you know, Goodbye to Language, which feels like a grand artistic statement as well, considering we talked a lot about the linguistic interests of his early works. And he's doing some of the craziest shit you've ever seen in a movie. I guess some people already have seen it and have been lucky enough to see it in the cinema. I'm not sure about you, but there's just this moment where he's experimenting with 3D and he makes a type of shot that has, again, never been done before in the history of cinema. And he's doing it in, what, 2014 or something? I'm not sure if you know this shot, but there's a moment in that film. So the film is made in 3D. And he plays a lot in his typical late essayistic Godard sense, where, again, he's doing two things at the same time all the time. And 3D is perfect for that because you have layers, right? You have a foreground and a background. There's this shot where people are in a park on a bench and something happens off screen. And the camera pans to what happens off screen. It seems to be a murder or something. There's a crime component to it. But at the same time, a part of the camera stays in the park at that bench that you're looking at. So one part of the camera pans to the right and one stays right ahead. So the image breaks. It's a new kind of split screen. But you can kind of control what you want to see with your own eyes through the 3D glasses by closing one eye or closing the other, or kind of like focusing on one side of the image or the other, that image becomes sharp and the other one becomes like mushy and blurry. So it almost makes like a choose your own adventure in very cheap 3D technology, and nobody has ever done it before. You know, those kind of things were incredibly inspiring to me. Also, that film is mostly about his dog. Just him and his dog in Switzerland going to the lake, filming his dog, and then having all these like poetic voiceovers. It's kind of like Godarian thing. He's just like a mumbling old man, and half of the time I don't even know what he's talking about, but I love it. You know, I'm soaking it up. I'm like, yes, let's fucking go. He's more interested in two things, in just playing around with the film image and making kind of like philosophical quandaries about it, and his dog. And the rest can just kind of fuck himself, you know? He makes films almost by himself with a couple of trusted people, and that's it. I love it. So I'm going to go on the line and just say that I understand where he was coming from at that moment. I'm sorry.
His most famous quotes, of course, is like, every movie has a beginning, a middle, and an end, but not necessarily in that order.
Yeah.
You sort of went there now.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's true. Well, I want to add maybe one thing that I thought was also very funny, and I'm wondering what you think of it, but also in late stages of his life, whenever he had to make a grand media appearance, he would do so over FaceTime or Instagram. When he gave a press conference after his final movie, The Image Book, Livre d'Image, he was in Cannes with the press conference on FaceTime. And it was just in front of a zillion microphones and cameras. And people are just recording the sound that comes from his phone. So he's, again, just kind of like, I like that he embraced this new technology and never stopped being curious while being a total hermit and recluse in his own house in Switzerland. And one of the biggest last interviews that he gave was on Instagram Live, where he went and talked for 45 minutes or so about film and many other things, I guess. You can find it online with English subtitles, by the way. But just, yeah, he found still ways to be a present artist, but in a different form. And in that sense, he still was maybe fresh and relevant. I don't know. Hasn't he always been that?
I guess the quality that you're highlighting that I've never really seen in Godard's life is his secrecy, or especially the comfort of his own life and finding adventures within the walls of his own house, basically, is something that is such an unattractive idea for me, and is exactly the opposite of what Agnes Varda has done in her life. So I completely understand why he hasn't opened the door for her, because she's there at 94 or whatever, you know, still doing the same thing that she was doing when she was 20 something, going on the bus or on the train and going all through France and, you know, finding the, what you would describe as finding two things and putting them together as one. Or I would
such
say
a generous
Captain Planet,
or
with all their powers combined, which,
kiwi, apple, fruit.
I have met the fruit.
No, but it's something you could also
I'm so
see,
generous for Varda now,
see as associative adventure. I would,
yeah,
is
yeah,
what
yeah.
You
no,
could
that's
call
a
it.
Better way of phrasing it.
But it's like such a sad. Again, douchebaggery way of growing old, which is...
I again disagree.
Yeah, yeah, that's
totally fine.
I think
every great artist, but every person in general also deserves to, you know, bracket off their own way of in which they want to make art and be a public figure.
Absolutely.
And he has managed...
It translates in his films. Yes. Like, he plans out every route of his adventure. And you can follow that route and dig really, really deep into it. And I guess that is also the joy of Godard and also the reason why you can rewatch something for a bazillion times and go further into his train of thought about things. The adventure is gone for me.
I have one
sense.
Very, very funny thing about the image book, which is his grand final video essay film about, again, you know, the book as a superior form opposed to film, and about also his whole obsession with the Middle East as a new kind of like as an unexplored territory also for Western thinkers, blah, blah, blah. Just all political component there as well. But he cites many, many films. Again, also Tommy cites Vertigo and all these other beautiful stuff and many writers and many poets and paintings and... But there's also a moment in the film where there's just like a couple of shots from a porn movie. And then in the credits of the film where he lists all the things that he cited, you have all these kind of like Hitchcock and this and that. And then just one mention, porn. Just very literally porn. No source, no nothing, which is... but it just felt very funny. That's the most literal thing in the film and that it's also described as the most literal film.
But again, deeply disrespectful because that porn movie was made by Agnes Varda. So, you
know, yeah, it's that film is called Varda Par Varda. That's
so horrible.
Oh. You know, that is a whole new way of reading faces, places, isn't it?
It only goes to show that the French Nouvelle Vague in so many ways was this fascinating nexus of so many philosophical, artistic, political voices coalescing around a same era, somehow finding a shared aspiration and ambition and belief in how they wanted to change cinema and indeed not be like the cinema of yore, the cinema du papa. And then that so many of those voices blistered and kind of like went off in their own direction and all did something interesting with it. And then that there is such a mild distance between some of the latest remaining figures of that movement, Varda and Godard, only goes to show how special it was in the first place that they were all doing that together.
It is absolutely special.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, fully it's, agree.
So this is the most pretentious double down on what it meant. What the Renaissance was for normal art.
For normal art.
Art. Nouvelle Vague certainly was for cinema.
Yes, but then, you know, realizing your own intelligence and brilliance and then reflecting upon that and continuing to create stories upon your own brilliance is just so Kanye West. Or, you know, like there's a lot of parallels there that I'm not going to go into. But
yeah, I understand what you're saying. And I think it's a matter of taste, but it's... In my opinion, in a sense, that's also what being an artist can be about and in sometimes also should be about. And I'd rather have a figure like him doing that till the very end, till his last days, instead of not doing it at all. So we should, I guess, be thankful.
Well, I must say that to conclude with a Latin phrase, so we didn't really go for the de mortuis nil nisi bene, you know? You are only kind for the dead, right? That's not what we did here. So that's cool. But still, come watch all his films at Lab 111 or other cinemas.
Oh, and can I do one quick plug? Because if
sure.
if this podcast gets released on time on the 22nd of November, so this will be for a very limited round, a very limited moment when this episode airs, I'm screening and giving an introduction before Godard's final film. So if you either want to disagree with me or want to, you know, be at my side and, you know, savor the artistic brilliance of his late era, come to the iFilm Museum and we'll watch his final film, which, you know, is a good send-off, I guess, for the master of yore as well.
And your career.
Yes. I'll be there. I'll applaud.
Well, there you have it. As you know, this episode is sponsored by Mubi, a creator streaming platform. In partnership with Lab 111, you can enjoy the first 30 days free at mubi.com/lab111. There you'll find handpicked films, including ones we celebrate here on this podcast. Our pick for this month include three films, Masculine and Feminine by Godard, Cleo from 5 to 7 by Agnes Varda, and Night Tide by Curtis Harrington. Our next episode will be about film noir. We'll take a trip down Nightmare Alley.
Tales from Nightmare Alley.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on whichever platform you use so more people can find us. Make sure to subscribe and stay up to date with all new releases. You can follow us on Lab111 on Instagram. Feel free to send us any questions at celebratingcinema@lab111.nl. As always, we provide show notes and include all films mentioned, as well as links to tickets at screenings here at Lab 111. This was a production produced and edited by me, Liam. Music from Hugo Amazal and artwork by Studio FFF. Thank you very much for listening, and until next time.
Yay!
Bye!
Ciao, ciao!
Au revoir,
adieu,
adieu,
Maline
langage.
De chance! Maline de chance! Maline de chance! Dis-moi, chérie, qu'est-ce que t'en penses?
Oh, ce que j'en pense, quelle importance! C'est fou ce que j'aime, ta ligne de hanche! Ta ligne de hanche.
Ma ligne de chance.
J'aime la caresser de mes mains. Ta ligne de hanche.
Ma ligne de chance.
C'est une fleur dans mon jardin.